Hi everyone, welcome to another episode of Soulful, the podcast that reveals everything you ever wanted to know about sneakers, hosted by myself, Kish Cash and Jason Coles. Yo Jay, what's new mate? What's new? What's going on mate?
Well, really excited about this episode. It's an extra special one because we know there are so many superstar fans out there. I have to say, very special for me. I first got to know our guest today, the legendary Chris Avern, father of the shoe. About 5 years ago when I was writing Golden Kicks and researching it, and I think we had like a three-hour conversation all about the shoe. And I came away from that, thinking, you know, this guy is just extraordinary, as I hope our listeners are about to find out.
Definitely.
He's responsible for one of the greatest sneakers of all time. And, you know,
iconic.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And you know, what I found when I met Chris was I couldn't believe that for the most part he was kind of forgotten about for about 30 years. But
that is ridiculous. Seriously. Well, talk about an unsung hero of the game. Full respect for you, for, you know, when you was researching the book, chatting to him for 3 hours. I want to know what we're going to find out. Right, you spoke to him for 3 hours.
Yeah.
Right, going in depth, and that's well documented now. What are we going to get out of him today, though?
Well, I'm pretty sure it's going to be some amazing stuff. So, ladies and gentlemen, all the way from Thousand Oaks in California, Mr. Chris Avern.
Chris, yo, before you got into the, you know, the sports shoe business, you were actually a bit of a Hollywood star, weren't you? There was a moment where you had your 15 minutes of fame.
Actually, it was 16 and a half minutes. Yes, I was a child actor.
Wow.
First film I was in happened to win the Academy Award, Best Picture. It's a film that should resonate very strongly with people in England. The film is called Mrs. Miniver. Best Picture of the Year, 1942, starring Greer Garson, Walter Pidgeon, and other quite famous people at the time. The film won Best Picture. Greer Garson won Best Actress, and David Wyler was Best Director.
Wow.
There's a lot of interesting history about that film, but Winston Churchill said that film did more to boost English morale in World War II than any single thing.
Wow.
Wow. Amazing.
Whoa.
You have Winston Churchill's endorsement, Chris. I mean, that's a pretty good start to your career.
That's amazing.
Yeah, so anyway, I'm the youngest member of the Miniver family.
Wow.
And my name is in the film is Toby.
That's crazy. Is that the only film experience that you had, or was you what happened after that?
I was in approximately, I was in 8 films. Perhaps more importantly, my family, we did over 50 films during the glory Hollywood years.
Whoa.
I have brothers and sisters, 2 sisters, mm-hmm. and 6 brothers, and we were all in the movies.
Okay, so your family that you're referring to, right? They were also involved in sportswear distribution. Is that correct? Were you guys, you know, what was the story behind that?
Well, the first sport I learned to play was cricket. My dad was a very excellent cricket player.
Mm-hmm.
The family migrated to the USA in 1935.
Whoa.
And most of the family were already born, but 3 of us were born in the USA.
And so what was the association between the family and Adidas at that stage? Was there one, or?
Well, that's quite a long story, but I'll sort of capsulize it for you. The family all played cricket. We did this on the weekends, and interestingly enough, at the time, there were a lot of famous Hollywood movie stars from England that were playing in various films. So they formed a cricket team, and we played in Griffith Park, which is in Southern California in the LA area, and there were about 8 other teams, and so there was a cricket league, and that's how I grew up, and those movie stars, some of which you would recognize if you're a classic film buff, they all played. As a result of that, there was some interaction with the studios because they needed actors, children, who had English accents. And our family had quite a few, shall we say, usable characters in the group. And so we did quite a bit of movie work in those days. Now, having played cricket, there's another sport that they play in England, not too much here. It's field hockey.
Right.
And so my brother Cliff was really a very good cricket player, and he would try to import some cricket bats and balls and stumps and what have you, because nothing was available in the USA. So as importing that, he also brought in field hockey sticks and shin guards and other things, and had a very small, tiny sporting goods business in the LA area, but catering to the few cricket teams that existed. But he did a pretty good business in field hockey because all of the girls' high school teams, they all played field hockey. So that was his business. And he, from time to time, would bring in samples. One day, a pair of Adidas shoes came floating in. Cliff was an athlete beyond cricket, and he ran a track at UCLA. So when he saw this track shoe with bright blue kangaroo uppers and white stripes, it dazzled him, because every sports shoe at that time was black.
Right.
If you look at all the old pictures of Olympics and other events, Roger Bannister breaking the 4-minute mile, you'll see everybody's wearing track shoes that are solid black.
Right.
There are no markings, no logos, no identifying marks on the track shoes. And they were a little bit on the heavy side, and so the Adidas shoes were lighter, and of course they looked radically different. They had what appeared to be a handicap. The spikes were not interchangeable. They were permanent. So if you broke off a spike, tough luck. You
had to buy a new pair.
It actually made the shoes much lighter, because in order to have interchangeable spike back in those days, you had to have metal plates inside the shoes and receptacles to hold the spikes. Well, the Adidas shoe was nearly 50% lighter.
Wow.
Because none of those heavy-duty materials were in the front sole of the shoe. So there was an attraction to the shoe being light, and the looks were different. But it was not possible to sell the shoes, because at that time, which was not long after World War II, there was a Buy American policy in the USA.
Really?
You could not buy goods from either Japan or Germany for a while.
Wow.
In other words, the law was, or the rule was, if there is an equivalent American-made product, you had to buy the American-made product. If there was no USA equivalent product, then you could buy something from Japan. And so we tried to make the case there really was no equivalent product, that the Adidas shoes were so much better that there was no equivalent. That was a good approach, but it didn't work. So ultimately what happened was the head coach at UCLA, where Cliff ran track a few years before, he said, I really do like the shoes, but the school cannot buy them. If the athletes want to buy them themselves, that's okay with me. So we began selling spike track shoes, one pair at a time, to athletes, and either hand-delivering them or sending the shoes by postal service, parcel post. There wasn't any FedEx or UPS or DHL.
Wow.
And so it was really a one pair at a time operation. And that's how the track shoes, at least, were introduced.
Right.
All these other shoes that exist now did not exist. There were just spike track shoes, a few crude flat running shoes, and some football boots, meaning soccer football boots.
Right.
That was it.
So, Chris, was there a moment that you can kind of say was the genesis of the superstar?
The very first inkling of something happening was when I met Horst Dassler in 1956. He was arriving in the USA, preparing for the Australian Olympics, the Summer Olympics in Melbourne, Australia. And he was on assignment here, his very first assignment as a young man, to find out the shoe sizes of the track and field athletes who would be competing on the USA team.
Right.
My brothers and I followed the sport very closely, and we knew who the best athletes were, but then we had to contact them individually in order to find out their shoe sizes. And in some cases, we were actually able to outfit them in shoes. We sold them the shoes. They didn't give them the shoes. And they would talk it up to the other track athletes, saying, these are fabulous shoes, and so on and so on. So anyway, before we became acquainted with some of the very best performers, the team, the USA team, is not selected just because you're rated highly. You have to go through the Olympic trials. The Olympic trials had not yet taken place, and the first three finishes at the trials were selected on the team. So we got as many sizes as we could, gave them to Horst. Horst flew back to Herzog, and they began working on shoes, making individual shoes for those athletes in those sizes. And by the time all the dust settled and we found out who did make the team, all the sizes were in the factory. They were working on them, and Horst packed his bags and a few pieces of luggage and arrived in Australia with sufficient shoes to equip some of the top athletes.
Wow.
Then Horst and I became close friends after that, and I had suggested to him, this was a few years later, why don't we make basketball shoes? He was polite, but he wasn't interested at all. Was moving along, learning the business from the Dasslers, his parents, Adi Dassler and Kathy Dassler, and he was assigned to go to France to set up a second manufacturing center. And this was in a little tiny village called Landersheim and in an abandoned factory in Detwiller. So that's where he was. Now, he heard what I had to say, but he was very busy. They were trying to get manufacturing started, and he just sort of said, well, I'll keep it in mind for the future. Then he went to the 1960 Olympic Games in Rome, and for the first time in his life, he saw basketball at a high level. The USA team was composed of some of the finest players who ever played the game, and they are now in the Basketball Hall of Fame. And so he saw the sport through new eyes, and he was absolutely fascinated. And when he came back from Rome, he said, yes, it'd be a great idea to make basketball shoes. He was very new in the business. He didn't have any financial control. And so he talked to his parents about it. And his parents said, don't waste your time on basketball. It's a very small sport. And we are on top of the world in track and field, the Olympic Games, and we're doing very well at the World Cup level. And our two big sports are soccer, football, and track and field. Don't waste your time on basketball. So that was the official reaction. All right? So he came back to me and
that's crazy.
And told me what the story was. And I obviously was not happy. So I asked him a question. I asked him, what are we going to do? And he looked at me, paused for a moment, and said, we are going to make basketball shoes. And
that's brilliant.
Then,
that is brilliant.
Then he said, but my parents must not find out about it. So we will need to, we will need to develop the shoes so that they are not aware of it. Now, they were hundreds of miles apart, so a horse did have some privacy. And with a technician and myself and Horst, we started to consider a basketball shoe. And I can remember Horst posing a question to me. He said, now that we've decided that we're going to make basketball shoes, how do we make them? He literally asked me, how do we make them? They have never made basketball shoes. Right. They never played basketball shoes, and so on and so on. So they right. were relying on me to step by step, along with them and the technical team, to create a basketball shoe from the ground up. And so it began with deciding we are not going to make canvas basketball shoes. All basketball shoes were made in canvas, 100%, everything. And the top shoe was Converse All-Star. And that ruled the day with all college, professional, and so on. And there were other brands like Bata and Uniroyal, but they were canvas. And they tried to their best to look like a Converse All-Star. So it appeared that every single basketball player was wearing Converse All-Stars, even though they might not be, because the shoes all looked exactly the same. The only distinguishing feature of the Converse shoe was that it had a little star on it. If it was a high top, it had a little heel patch with a star on it. And if it was a low-cut shoe, it had a little star affixed to the outsole near the heel. And that was it. Otherwise, all shoes looked the same. So we decided we're going to make leather shoes. One of the reasons for that was they were not able to work with canvas at that time. And we wanted the shoes to look different. So the quest or the goal became, how do we build a better basketball shoe? I made this point. We don't want to make a shoe that's just as good as Converse. We have to make a shoe that is better. And so this began for me with the ground up. I played in Converse basketball shoes in high school, and that was the state of the art, and I was very proud to be bouncing around on the court. But I did find that some of those shoes would cause foot problems for me, and at times, depending on the condition of the floor, the traction or the grip on the floor was not very good, and there was some slipping and sliding. So I told Horst, the first thing we have to do is to make sure we have a shoe that grips the floor better. So that was number one on how to make a better basketball shoe. Number two, we thought a leather upper would give more support than a canvas. And then support, a lot of it had to occur in the heel area. And so we decided we're going to make heel counters that are very, very stable, very firm to prevent twisting or spraining the ankle. It doesn't stop at 100%, but it was an improvement. And then we decided that, and I noticed that when I would tie up my shoes, my Converse shoes, if I tied them up really tight, it would cut off your circulation in the foot. So we decided we wanted to have a padded tongue so that when you tied up your laces, you wouldn't cut off the circulation.
So hold on a second there, Chris, right? Hold on. The padded tongue was an innovation between you and Horst Dassler.
Well, yes, you can.
Because we take this for granted.
Okay, in the end,
We take a padded tongue for granted these days.
Kish, you have to remember that neither Horst and I can operate machines that cut leather nor stitch the shoes together. And this and that. So all we could do is describe what we wanted, and then the people who could actually fulfill those requests, they would make the shoes. So I want to go on record saying I never made a pair of superstar basketball shoes, but I would say, I would say that I developed that shoe every single step of the way. So at the time, the shoes were made in a traditional way. And when I say that, I'm talking more about the way training shoes were made. We looked at a shoe called the Olympiad, and it was a white shoe with black stripes. It was actually developed for the 60 Olympics, and it wasn't what I would call a great running shoe, but it was a very comfortable shoe to walk around in. And so Horst would try to get the athletes to wear them in the Olympic Village so that there were lots of three stripes that were visible. And that shoe sort of had the look that I liked to it. So I said, why don't we make shoes white uppers with black stripes? That's a neutral color, and that should be our first go round. Mm-hmm. Superstars have shell toes on them, and the sole, the outsole, is an all-in-one sole, and it's better described as a dish sole. But long before those existed, we would stamp out the soles in sheets of rubber. You can just imagine a sheet of rubber, and then a machine would come down, stamp out the sole, and that would be glued on to the shoe while it was on the last. In other words, the leather is formed around the shoe last, and then the sole, first the insole, then the outsole, and sometimes a midsole, which included a wedge in the heel, were glued on, okay? You could say it was cemented on, but it was an adhesive that held the uppers and the shoes together. To make sure, though, unlike a training shoe, which doesn't have a whole lot of lateral movement, you're running straight ahead, basketball is a lot of stop and go, a lot of quick moves laterally. And so more or less locked in the different layers with what they call foxing. It was a strip of rubber that went all around the shoe. And that was basically the look of the shoe. Visually, it looked a bit like the Olympiad, but it had features in it that did not exist.
What was the name of the shoe?
We decided to call it the Super Grip because I wanted to emphasize the fact that it really grabbed the floor really well. So in my mind, the most important thing was the traction. I came up with the name Super Grip. And at the time,
this is crazy.
At the time, it was a perfect description of what the shoe could do.
Totally. I mean, the thing is, when we look back with what you're saying with regards to basketball technology and the history of the shoes, this is a groundbreaking moment.
Let's just say all of the canvas shoes at that time were from an earlier era, and that was the state of the art. Now, I don't want to give you the impression that I couldn't play basketball in Converse shoes, because I could, and so could everybody else. I just wanted to make sure our shoe was better than the Converse. The first prototypes, I have to tell you, were a long way from what the superstar is now. In other words, those earlier models were trial and error. And so we learned and kept taking it step by step. We found out that the shoes actually fell apart playing basketball, that they couldn't stand up to the stress.
That's not a great look.
they couldn't stand up to heavy, let's call it G-forces, of all the different movements. And so typically they would separate in the toe area. So we tried to figure out a way how to strengthen the toe area. And we did that by taking little strips of rubber and gluing them on to the front of the shoe, somewhat like a bumper.
Right.
And so it was just something that came up slightly over the edge of the outsole. But it helped, okay? But it didn't solve the problem. We kept doing various things until eventually we decided we need to make the shoe in a different way. Instead of doing layers of soles, why don't we try to make an all-in-one sole in a mold, and then we can put the different cushioning layers inside that one-piece sole, like a dish, so it would hold everything. And so we made, a big breakthrough is coming up with the dish sole, an all-in-one sole. And so we thought, we've got the problem solved. Unfortunately, we did not have the problem solved because the shoes kept coming apart, even with the dish sole, because of the great stress on the shoes. And Adidas kept trying to improve the glue or the cement that would hold the shoes together. But that still didn't solve the problem, no matter what they tried. A kind of a last-ditch effort. We took some of the protos I had to a shoemaker and said, why don't we try stitching the soles to the uppers? And so this was done in a very crude way. I have the original shoe, by the way, that this was
really
done to. I have a few shoes, Kish, that would probably be interesting for you. I have the very, very first low-cut basketball shoe ever made. It was a prototype. Looks like the Olympiad. It's not very pretty, but it's the actual shoe.
But it works.
Yeah, exactly. That's the moment. Yeah.
And then
that's
then I also have this attempt to stitch the outsole to the upper. And you will see that the stitch is very erratic. It's zigzags up and down and so on. And I thought to myself, how is this tiny little piece of thread going to hold the shoe to the upper? But lo and behold, it did. It worked.
Wow.
Between the glue, which was getting better, and the stitching, it was just enough to hold the shoe together. Even with the stitching and with the bumper, we could still rip out the shoes in the toe area. So this is when we started looking at different toe caps. How can we strengthen the toe area? This led to what you now know as the shell toe. And that pretty much solved the problem.
That's mad, because I always thought the shell toe, right, was to stop someone treading on your feet. You know what I mean? You're in close quarters playing basketball and someone treads on your toes. I mean, that's it. You're out the game. So that's what I thought. It was toe protection, but from the other way around. That's crazy.
The full rubber toe cap would deform. It would dent in. While it was on the shoe last, it was okay. It kept its shape. But when it came off the last, the shoe would the toe would deform and it would dip in to the tops of the toes and it would cause blisters on the tops of the toes. Ooh. So when I started getting the professional players in the shoes and they used the shell toe, almost all of them complained that the toes are ruining their feet. And so I decided we better make shoes for the professionals that just had a soft leather toe cap, but with a bumper that came partway up the toe, but not on top of the toe. And so the professional players all played in what we might call a half shell.
The half shell. The half shell. I love that shoe, the half shell.
Okay.
It got retroed a few years ago, but the reason
for it is because the full shell was causing blisters.
So what's the difference, right, between the shell toes that were made back then to now?
Well, you have to remember when I said we had a full, like, rubber toe cap, it was really made of different materials. It wasn't always the same. In other words, the shell toe came on a little bit later as far as the look with the lines that made it look like a seashell. But we had different thicknesses of rubber and materials. I would say even when we did finally get to the look of the shell toe, it still had trouble. And it could be that they didn't leave it on the last too long. In other words, they took it off too soon, and the glue would pull at the outer surface, the rubber surface on top, and cause it to deform. And I was in such a hurry to get shoes, I was pushing Adidas. I was the only one who had the shoes, and I was putting them on professional players because our U.S. distributors would not sell them. They thought it was a crazy idea, and when we tried to introduce the shoe to the U.S. distributors, there were four of them, they just kind of looked and they said, this is not going to work. Basketball players like to play in canvas shoes, and these don't look like basketball shoes. And they politely declined to order any shoes. And that was another problem.
Wow.
And that was another problem because then Horst looked at me after years of development and said, okay, we did everything you asked us to do, and now nobody wants to buy these shoes.
Chris, you mentioned that, you know, during all this time, you'd had to, or you and Horst had to create the shoe basically in secret, didn't you? We had a question in from one of the listeners, Mark Albus, who was asking, you know, was there any influence at all from Adi Dassler? Because obviously, you know, he's the renowned shoemaker as such, but did he have any involvement at all in the Superstar?
Years before, there was a superstar or a pro model or a serious attempt at basketball shoes. Adi Dassler in Germany made a shoe called the All Round. And the All Round had a high top on it, like a basketball shoe, but it had a sole that absolutely would not work for a basketball shoe. And it was a shoe developed by Adi Dassler for all types of sports, for weightlifters, you know, anything that you could sort of like do indoors. That was his idea of an all-round, almost like a gymnastic shoe, a badminton shoe.
Was this the first example? Was this the first example of a multi-purpose sports shoe?
Yeah, I would say so. But the all-round was, if you see the shoe and handled it, you'd say, no, this is not a basketball shoe. But to answer the question from your listener, Adi Dassler himself had nothing to do the development of the basketball shoe. It was Horst Dassler, the son of Adi Dassler. He's the one who pushed this through. And as a matter of fact, as you heard, we were doing this in secret. We did not want to let the cat out of the bag that we were working on this shoe. So I can assure you...
Black Ops.
I can assure you that if Adi Dassler himself found out we were doing this, he would have stopped it in its tracks. So,
wow. Yeah. Which is ironic in a way, isn't it? Considering it's gone on to be probably, you know, one of the best-selling Adidas shoes of all time.
One of the most iconic.
The two shoes that I had a lot to do with were the Stan Smith, what you now know as the Stan Smith tennis shoe, and the Superstar. And these are the two biggest-selling shoes today, 50 years later, of Adidas.
Well, that was another question that we had in from one of the listeners, Chris, was a guy from Blunt Shank, who is kind of a renowned superstar fan. Now, he was asking about your involvement with the Stan Smith, because most people don't realize that.
The shoe was an early attempt, and the sole was constructed somewhat the same way as the early basketball shoes. The tennis shoe and the basketball shoe were developed in parallel, more or less in the same time frame. But the outsole was a crepe sole. It was a different look to it, and it did not have the same gripping characteristics as the super grip. But eventually, the shoe was improved, and it was decided that we need to make a one-piece dish sole for the tennis shoe as well. But we don't want it to look identical to the superstar. It wasn't a superstar at that time, the super grip. And so it was decided we have to come up with a different sole profile. And so eventually it became a series of nubs. If you turn the shoe over and look at it, you'll see that the sole looks entirely different as far as the profile compared to the superstar. The outsole for the Stan Smith shoe and the outsole for the superstar were developed at the same time.
Did the Supergrip sole have a herringbone pattern, which was later, you know, transferred over to the superstar?
It did. Remember now, we're dealing with just sheets of rubber. Rubber had to be very soft in order to grip the floor. If it's too hard, it's great for outdoor use, but it doesn't grip the floor. And there were a couple of shoes that I used as my guideposts. One was a shoe called the Viking, which you've never heard of. The Viking was a canvas shoe. I think it, if I'm not mistaken, it came from the Netherlands. It had a gum rubber sole that looked like a bunch of spaghetti that was glued together. And it kind of had a zigzag shape to it, not exactly a herringbone, a gum rubber sole, and that's why I liked it. And I used that in my early experimentation. And the other shoe that kind of guided me was a Sperry Topsider. That's a shoe made for decks on boating.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay,
yeah.
So between the Viking shoe and the Sperry Topsider to inspire me, I decided we need to have a more of a zigzag look and to have the sole to be the right consistency so that it would grip the floor. If it's too soft, it would just wear out too quickly because basketball, again, is very tough on shoes. But if it's too hard, then it doesn't grip the floor. So it had to have just the right consistency to do the gripping. And so the zigzag, because it has different angles, no matter which way you go, back, forwards, side to side, you have some gripping edges making contact with the floor. So the decision was to go with the herringbone look. However, when we made the superstar, we decided to make each rib, each piece of zigzag, to be longer, deeper, and more flexible. So it grabbed the floor even better. Okay, so eventually we improved the outsole.
There's, you're discussing so many numerous advances within footwear technology that we take for granted right now. But it's absolutely fascinating to talk to you about this process of development, which to us seems second nature now, but if you hadn't done it with your team and on the vision of yourself and Horst Dassler, I don't know what we would be looking at on our feet right now. It's quite remarkable. It really is.
It is amazing, isn't it? Chris, can I just ask you, why did you decide to change the name from Supergrip to Superstar?
I think Supergrip served its purpose to let the athlete know, the basketball player know that you're going to really be able to have good footing. You're really going to be able to grab the floor. But about that time, after we had the shoes rolling along, the term superstar was coming into vogue in the entertainment field.
Right.
Okay. And even
that's something that you were very familiar with as a kid.
Right. So we decided, let's call Arshu the superstar, which is one notch above an all-star. You can be an all-star, but...
Okay.
So actually it was...
So you were gunning for the competition.
It was, we wanted to be, like I said, make a better shoe than the Converse All-Star, and we also wanted to have a better name than the Converse All-Star. So it became the superstar, right. And that turns out to be a very important part of the success of the shoe, the fact that it is called the superstar.
That's right, because this is a moment in sort of sports marketing where you look at it and go, right, okay, this shoe, right, it's like, you know, we've got subsequent campaigns that say you can do this with the shoe, etc. This is the first time you wearing this shoe, you are a superstar and you will play like a superstar.
That's it. That's it.
Let me share something with you, which is below the surface. Horst Dassler, actually, I came up with superstar, but he said to me, we're not quite ready yet. Let's make sure we've got the shoe just right before we call it a superstar. So we were still in the process of making the shoe better, improving the shoe in little ways. And then when Horst was convinced that the shoe was as good as we could get it, he said, now is the time to use the name Superstar. He didn't want to have any abortive launches. In other words, we come out with the Superstar, the shoe falls apart, and the shoe is now dead. So we made sure that the shoe was fully functional and desirable before we came up with the name Superstar.
So one thing I want to know is you've developed this shoe in secret for numerous years, a bit like, you know, Area 51 and all the crazy stuff that goes on in that place, right, and all the super spacecrafts and whatever that's going on over there. So you got this equivalent, this Black Ops equivalent of a shoe, Germany, right? Herzo, right? Adi Dassler. What did he say and how did he, well, actually, how did he find out about what you guys were doing and then what did he think?
It was a grudging acknowledgement that the shoe was a success, but there were family problems going on. And I don't necessarily think we have the time to drag you into all of that. The basketball shoe was actually such a bone of contention, it almost led to Horst Dassler leaving Adidas.
Whoa.
Okay, wow. and moving
That's
in
incredible.
A... It wasn't the only factor. I'm quite sure it was the headstrong Adidasler and more so Kathy Dassler, the mom. Actually, Adidasler was not a political animal. He loved to create shoes. And he was really good. Horse mother, Kathy Dassler, properly pronounced Kate, but Kathy Dassler was really going hot and heavy, knocking heads with Horse all the time. And they basically thought Horse was getting too big for his britches. And so the basketball shoe, instead of being welcomed as a success, it became a big bone of contention. And then there were other issues as to the way the business was run, the type of shoes that would be made, and was getting worse and worse and worse. But one of the issues was the basketball shoes and Chris Severn. They thought I was a bad influence on Horst Dassler.
Still is, apparently.
However, they never actually said that to my face. I would have to say they treated me very well when I was in person. So these battles went on behind the scenes, but I found out about them.
Wow.
Right. How did you end up getting NBA players to actually wear them?
I was trying to figure out how am I going to get the shoes on the pro players because the distributors wouldn't buy the shoes. And so... when Horst asked me the question, now what are we going to do? I said, we are very close. I said, if you will turn me loose, I will somehow, some way get professional players to wear these shoes. And so during a summer league where the pros work out and also rookies who are going to be drafted onto pro teams, I made the acquaintance of a John Block. John Block was about a 6'10", excellent player out of the University of Southern California. And he was an All-American, which is the highest honor you can get at the collegiate level. And he was having foot problems. And I happened to have a pair of shoes his size. I told him to try on the shoes. This was during the summer league. And he did. And he loved them. And his foot problems cleared up. Wow. So he became kind of like a spokesman for me among the... the players during the pro league. So I got a few more players into the shoes. I only had like maybe 10 pairs of shoes altogether. There were not lots of shoes floating around. So each pair of shoes was very precious.
Very valuable indeed, yeah.
Right.
So I gave John a pair and he was very grateful. He ended up getting picked by the Lakers, the LA Lakers, which at the time was the number two team in the NBA. The Boston Celtics at that era were number one, LA Lakers number two. They always met each other in the finals in these huge battles for the title. But anyway, Block was drafted onto the Lakers, and he reported to camp, preseason camp, and he was wearing Adidas. The coach, Fred Schaus, looked at him and said, "Block, what do you have on your feet?" And he told him they were like a new type of basketball shoe. And he said, "Those don't look like basketball shoes, and you're not going to make the Lakers look foolish by wearing those shoes. So forget it." He said, "Coach, I have to wear these shoes. My feet get so bad when I play in Converse shoes, it's going to actually diminish my performance." So they hit a compromise. He said, "You can practice in those shoes, but you're not wearing them out on the court." So that's where it ended up with the Lakers. He could practice in the shoes, but not wear them on the court. The following year, he was selected to play on the San Diego Rockets. And the San Diego Rockets was an expansion team, which means it was brand new, and they were allowed to pick up to two players from any existing team in the NBA, not more than two. And the teams would protect their very best players. And so typically, the players that were available to be on an expansion team would be at the tail end of the roster.
They weren't very good then, is what
you're
saying, Chris.
Do you know something? I have to say this, because I watched them play. They were very good. You have to be really good to make an NBA roster, okay? But they were not as good. That's the best way to say it.
It's fine margins.
Okay. But obviously some of them had talent. Anyway, John Block went to the Rockets and he wanted to make sure that he could wear those shoes. And so he talked to the coach, Jack McMahon, and he did his best to explain the shoes, but the shoes he had did not fit the coach. So John called me up and he says, "Do you happen to have a pair that would fit the coach?" And so I made a look through what I had, and I did have a pair of shoes. It was about a size 11. I said, "I'll come right down to San Diego." So I met the coach. He was a former All-Pro player from the St. Louis Hawks. That was before they became the Atlanta Hawks. Very good player, very good coach. And I put the shoes on his feet. He walked around in them and he says, "These are great." He says, "It's okay with me if you want to talk to the players. I'm not endorsing your shoes, but if they want to wear the shoes, they can wear them." So one by one by one, I started outfitting the San Diego Rockets in the shoes that I had.
This is the first team to wear all Adidas then,
correct?
Right? In the
that
NBA.
That is correct. Anyway, that was a major breakthrough. There's a little side story to that. Every time I would go to an exhibition game, They usually have like five or six or seven exhibition games before the season starts, just to get everybody in shape and used to working. And every time I would go to an exhibition game, the players were not wearing the shoes. And I'm saying to myself, oh my gosh, this is not going to work. These guys, in the end, they just like their Converse shoes better. They're used to them. They don't want to make any real changes here and jeopardize their careers and this and that. And so I was very, very disappointed. I was ready to give up until I attended the first preseason game. No, this was the actual opening game of the season. First actual game in San Diego. Yeah. The whole team came walking out in Adidas shoes.
Was that because they didn't want to destroy them before the season started?
That's exactly. They told me that. I said I didn't want to annoy them by asking them, why aren't you wearing the shoe? I gave you these shoes. You promised to wear the shoes. You're not wearing the shoes. I decided to keep your mouth shut and see what happens. So when they all showed up wearing the shoes, that was such a thrill for me to see that. And then I did speak up. I said, why weren't you wearing the shoes in the exhibition games? And they basically said, we did not want to wear the shoes out.
So, Chris, eventually the superstar and Adidas in general, you pretty much knocked Converse off the court, didn't you? I mean, how did you end up like taking over the NBA?
One player at a time. I would meet with the player. Right. They now, after the Rockets exposed the shoes, remember they had to play against one game at least every team in the league. So the players on the other team saw the shoes. They didn't know what they were, but the Rockets kind of told them about the shoes and me. And as they flew in, I would meet them at their hotel. And then I would knock on the door. It's not like that today, but I could actually just knock on the door, go into the room and meet the players and show them the shoes and have them try on a pair. And I did this literally one pair at a time with every player in the NBA.
How did the shell toe develop from the original Super Grip? How did the shell toe pattern happen? What was the inspiration behind that? And then also, I think Jace wants to talk to you about Mr. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, but I'll leave that one to him.
Okay. Well, I'm going to leave the shell toe a little bit of a mystery, but if you... but if you want to have some fun, and if you enjoy classic movies, you know, we started out talking about classic films. Okay, there's a film that you will enjoy watching. You may have already seen it. It's called Some Like It Hot. Do you ever remember that
film? Classic.
Tony Curtis and Marilyn Monroe.
Monroe.
I'm going to tell you to watch that film, okay? And there's a scene with Tony Curtis and Marilyn Monroe, and all I can tell you for now is you will see how the shell toe got started. Okay. So enjoy that. Right. Enjoy that.
So that's homework
and then,
for all the listeners.
Then we'll come back to the more scientific explanation.
Okay.
Cool. So Chris, apart from being the father of the superstar, one of your other kind of contributions to the Adidas legend was that it was you that signed Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, wasn't it?
It was in Chicago, and Horst Dassler was there for the NSGA show. That's the National Sporting Goods show that was every year. We signed Kareem, and there is a photo of Kareem actually with a smile on his face, which was a little difficult to get him to do back in those days, but he actually has a full-blown smile. And Horst Dassler is on one side, and I'm on the other side, and we're a happy trio. And so Kareem was the very first player that we paid money to. Prior to that, it was just the shoes and personal relationships and convincing the players that they could play better in the shoes, which would help them in their career. And that means if they are playing better, they'll get a higher contract. So it's very important that you be in the right shoes. Anyhow, whatever I said, whatever I did, all I can tell you is it worked. And the players wore them, and they were happy to wear them. And Kareem was quite happy to be paid, because to tell you the truth, I think he would have worn them anyway, whether we paid him or not. There was no Michael Jordan. Michael Jordan was in elementary school at that time.
There was only Kareem. There was only Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
That's amazing. Yeah. That is amazing. We've got three questions, because we've got to wrap things up, unfortunately. But we've got three questions more from our listeners. If we can please put them to you, Chris.
We'll try our best.
Okay. All right then. We've got one here from Spitzer Rock 51, I think, or Spitzer Rock 51. He goes, if he could choose to do a superstar collaboration with anyone, who would it be and why?
There are a few that would fall into that category. One would be Larry Jones. You've never heard of him. Larry Jones played in the in the ABA. He played for the Miami Floridians. He was like a missionary for me. He was like John Block in the ABA, and as Block was in the NBA. But he was a detail person, and he was like always doing whatever he could to help me, and he would share his experience. He was quite a good player. He could score double digits every game. So, and I will never forget Larry Jones.
So we've got another question from someone that you're pretty well acquainted with. It's Kick Posters, the incredibly talented Dan Freeburn. And he wants to ask you, if you were challenged to redesign or tweak the superstar for today, what would you change?
Great question.
All right. Well, as you may or may not know, this was the 50th anniversary, and I thought this might be the time to come out with the next generation of superstar. But I do not, how shall I word this? I am now in the process of reestablishing my relationship with Adidas, and it could happen very soon. I've already done a few things for them and with them, but this coronavirus thing hit, and we never got a chance to sort of put a final arrangement together. It's on hold now.
We got one last question as well from Dave Lurkey. Did you know that Adidas stands for All Day I Dream About Superstars?
I did know that, but I have to tell you there were different versions of what all day I dream about, and then any word you could come up that began with S, I've heard of it.
I think I've seen you in the t-shirt, Chris.
Oh, wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. Oh, man.
Chris, it's been an absolute pleasure. We've had so much fun with you today. I think we've learned, you know, so much about the superstar. There were some things you said there that, you know, I know a lot of the listeners, even the diehard superstar fans, will not have known. So thank you so much. It's been Chris. Great. And we'll have to get you on again one day, because I know there are so many more stories.
I can share a little secret with you. I have actually done a redesigned version of the superstar, which I unveiled to Zion Armstrong, who is the president of Adidas North America. He's been the president for 2 years, and I met him for the first time a couple of months ago, and he and I got along exceptionally well, and I showed him a prototype that I did myself, which was very difficult since I don't have a factory, I don't have machines, I don't have artists, and everything it takes to make a shoe. But somehow I pulled it off. And I showed him the prototype, and he seemed to be very, very pleased. And if all goes well, maybe we'll see that shoe in production.
I really hope so. I really hope so, Chris.
Yeah,
you know, that would be fantastic for us. Do you know what I mean? You know, and as Jay says, you know, thank you very much for taking the time to speak to us and drop in some incredible knowledge. And I'm sure the listeners will appreciate that wholesomely. Brilliant stuff. Well,
all the best.
You know what? Make sure you stay healthy.
And all the best, man. To the cool, Superstar fans throughout the UK.
Jace, right, you, Chris is a friend of yours, right? And you've had numerous, like, you know, chats over coffees or whatever, and especially with your book when you did Golden Kicks.
Yeah.
But dude, man, my mind was blown.
Yeah, it was
incredible.
Thought
I knew the superstar. I thought I knew the history of the superstar.
No, there was some amazing stuff there that Chris really hasn't said publicly before. So, you know, that will be a real treat for the Superstar fans out there. You know, the whole, you know, the story of the shoe and, you know, the relationship with the Stan Smith and, you know, how he got into the NBA. Incredible.
Yeah, definitely. We got to get him back on and talk to him about that, because I'm sure there's many tangents and aspects that we didn't even explore.
Exactly.
With him, you know.
Well, and amazing. You know, the great thing is that you know, as we said at the top of the show, the Superstar story, you know, begins with Chris, but it was taken on by the people, you know.
Yeah.
It really was the start of sneaker culture, hence why we've got a part two episode coming up with our good friend Thomas Turner.
Dr. Thomas Turner, PhD.
The doctor will be in the house again.
We need some letters after our name, mate. You know what I mean?
Oh,
there's a lot everyone else calls us. No, we don't talk about that. You know what I mean? We need some real letters behind our name. You know what I mean? Like that, you know what I'm saying? But yeah. But that's it for another episode. Thanks for listening. And remember to send us your questions to us on Twitter or Instagram at soulful_podcast. You can follow myself, Kish, Kish at KishCash1, and Jace at MadeByJace on Instagram. But yeah.
What another great one. That was fantastic. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. And if you like it, please do leave us a review. See you next time.